I represent a team of extremely talented women at Phillips 66. They're members of our Women's Employee Resource Group, and they're very passionate about creating an environment that connects, develops, and empowers women to achieve their potential, both personally and professionally. And I'm very proud of the work that they do. Phillips 66 continues to be a proud sponsor of this event, as we have been for the last several years. My formal role with Phillips is the General Manager for U.S. Product Supply and Distribution. And that's a fancy name for saying that I orchestrate the procurement and delivery of things like gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel from 11 of our U.S. refineries to the people that need it. That's either commodity traders, who I sometimes love and I sometimes hate, and third parties or our fuel marketing organization. And I'm very excited, actually, today to be your host for Survival Strategies in a Lean-In World. It's a subject I'm really familiar with. I'm the mother of three. I'm a wife. I'm a caregiver to my dad, a Girl Scout leader, a mentor, and a general manager. I'm frequently faced with choices and trade-offs that force me to prioritize and reprioritize what is important to me. Trade-offs are big and small. They are a staple on my menu. I regularly mentor women and men about how they need to think about framing up those trade-offs. Sometimes it's about time, it's about money, it's about attention, it's about human capital. All of them are finite resources, and we have to answer the question how we prioritize what's best for us. I told Joan before the panel that the latest trade-off I made was that I took a Girl Scout troop to the Arboretum on Sunday instead of painting my hair, as my son likes to call it. So today you're getting the almost brunette Jane. Today we're thrilled to have Joan Williams with us. She's going to be moderating a discussion about how we address those trade-offs with the help of three incredibly accomplished women who tirelessly advocate for progressing the work-family discussion around the globe today. They're going to address trade-offs, they're going to talk about prioritizing choices, and they're really going to get at how we find the delicate balance in our lives that we like to call sanity. It's very fun to read about Joan. People use words like rock star, powerhouse. My personal favorite was one of the feministing five. That highlighted her spectacular achievement of being only one of five women to deliver the prestigious Massey Lecture at Harvard University. Joan has been both central and instrumental in reshaping the debate over women's advancement during the past century. She's the Hastings Foundation Chair and the Director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. She's authored several books, including one she's going to be signing today, What Works for Women at Work, Four Patterns Working Women Need to Know. Joan has also been covered by all the major media resources, including Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Human Resources Executive, Jezebel, another favorite, O Magazine, and the Yale Law Journal. We're excited to have her with us. Let's welcome Joan and the panel.
Well, I'm so glad I came to Austin to find out I was one of the feministing five. This I didn't know. I am really jazzed about that, I have to tell you. Thank you, Jane, for that introduction. I'm going to start out today very briefly introducing our topic by just asking you a question. How do we define the ideal worker in our society? We really define the ideal worker as someone who starts to work in early adulthood and works full-time, full force for 40 years straight, taking no time off really for anything, right? That's the ideal worker. Okay, second question, how do we define the ideal mother? There's actually a social psychology experiment. It asks people, what is the good mother and what is the good father? A lot of overlap. One key divergence. The ideal mother is seen as someone who's always available to her children. So, question, can you be the ideal worker and the ideal mother? No. That's not a conflict that's in our heads. That's a conflict that is in the world. In fact, it's both outside and inside us. So it's outside us because if you think about the workforce for high-powered jobs today, we have a workplace that is perfectly designed for the workforce of 1960, right?
Right.
Because after all, that ideal worker, remember, no time off for childbirth? Well, pray tell, who does that describe? The ideal worker, no time off for child rearing, parental care, any kind of role like that. Who does that describe? You know, it's interesting. That doesn't describe just men. It describes men in a particularly particular family form, men married to homemakers. And so the workplace today is still designed around the homemaker breadwinner family of 1960. Now, one of the effects of that is what we call maternal role bias against mothers. This is one of the four basic patterns of gender bias that we talk about in the book I wrote with my daughter, What Works for Women at Work. Maternal role bias, which is gender bias triggered by motherhood, is an order of magnitude larger than glass ceiling bias. So if you give people identical resumes, one but not the other, a mother, otherwise identical, the mother is nearly 80% less likely to be hired, half as likely to be promoted, and offered an average of $11,000 less in salary. That's very, very strong bias. And so a lot of this is outside our heads, and we're going to be talking about that. But a lot of it's also inside our heads. Raise your hand if you've ever felt like, oh, my God, I'm not a good enough worker, or I'm not a good enough mother, or I'm not a good enough both. Right? So this clash of social ideals also lives inside us. And we're going to be talking about that as well. Partly the reason that we all feel kind of bad about ourselves is there's been a sharp ratcheting up of what it means to be a good mother. I mean, when I grew up in the 60s, if you think my mother was down on the floor playing with me to develop my talent in X and driving me to 14,000 lessons, you are wrong. You are wrong. The increase in economic anxiety in the United States has translated itself into incredible performance pressure on mothers and on children. So we're going to help you solve all those problems in the next 50 minutes with this amazing panel. The first panelist to my left is Katrina Alcorn. Katrina spent over 13 years in the very fast-paced world of high tech, and then she burned out and has written an amazing book called Maxed Out, American Moms on the Brink. Follow her her Working Moms Break blog, and we look forward to hearing from her as the first panelist. The second panelist is someone I've known about since, the 70s, Gail? When both Gail and I were young, as we still are today.
Yes.
Gail Shee is the author of 16 books, including the classic New York Times bestseller Passages, named by the Library of Congress as one of the 10 most influential books of our time. So we're honored, Gail, to have you here today as well. And the third panelist is Carrie Zane, who's an Emmy Award-winning television executive and Amazon best-selling author of It Takes All Five, A Single Mom's Guide to Finding the Real One. She also has an MA in spiritual psychology. Okay, ladies, first question. What is the best or worst advice you have ever received about surviving in the lean-in world? Let's start from Carrie.
That's good, because we rehearsed it, right?
We didn't rehearse any of this.
Yeah. The best advice I received is to be unapologetically relentless and know your worth. right? So what I mean by that is be relentless in whatever it is that you're striving for, whether it's to spend more time with your children, whether it's to make that sale, whether it's to get that promotion. Do it, but and know your worth, right? So I have spent 24 years as a television producer, and it is probably one of the most cutthroat businesses I know of. I've never worked in your business, so I don't know. Maybe it is the same, but it's pretty tough. You know, people will stab you in the back while you're still looking. So in that world, I was known as a nudge, but a likable nudge, because I would never give up. I was relentless about what I wanted to accomplish. And so I would slowly work it until I got what I wanted, which was the sale of the TV show. And it's a difficult thing to do, but I think if you keep your eye on the prize and you keep really focused, you can accomplish what you want to.
Okay, so be relentlessly pleasant, but ask for what you want. Gail?
Well, I was a girl journalist in the 1960s when I broke into a career that where females were expected to lean out. We were sequestered in the women's department of most newspapers or magazines and confined to writing about beauty and baking and being the helpmeet wife. Well, I wanted to write about hookers and the first bachelor mothers and women going to Selma to march with Martin Luther King. So I had to dare to break out of that place where we were sequestered. And I walked down the back stairs and crossed enemy lines into the city room, the testosterone zone, and approached Clay Felker, who was incubating New York Magazine in the pages of the Herald Tribune. And he said, "Where did you come from?" I said, "The estrogen zone." And he said, "What have you got for me?" And I spit out this story, my best story, and he said, "Okay, go for it." And I got the best advice of my career, which was, "You know, Gail, I've been reading your stories in the women's page. Just, if you want to make your name, don't keep writing little stories. No matter how good they are, they're not going to change the conversation. What you need to do is tackle a big story, something everybody's talking about, but they don't know the why." And I think you can substitute for story, you know, the big app, you know, the big idea, the big jump, the big risk. And that's why I say the best advice is really to be daring, to take a risk.
So you got to have a dream. If you don't have a dream, how is your dream going to come through? Katrina.
Okay, so, is this mic working? Can you guys hear me? You can't hear me. Oh, now can you hear me? Ooh, okay. I'll come really close. So I'm going to talk about the worst advice I received because, after all, I'm the one who maxed out and wrote a book about it. So 6 years ago, I had this absolutely fabulous job in high tech. I was managing a team of 17 designers at this very up-and-coming design firm in San Francisco. And I had a daughter and a stepdaughter, and I totally had it figured out. I did all the self-help. I was super efficient. I had a positive attitude, and it was working. And then I had my son, and it all went to hell. Because there's only so much you can do in a day, even if you do all the self-help and you do all the positive thinking. And so around that time, I started confiding in a few people that I was having some problems making it all work. And I got two bad pieces of advice. The first one was, just hang in there. It will get better. And sometimes that's good advice, but in my case, it wasn't, because I was just at the beginning. And the other advice that I got that was really bad is I was on the leadership team, and I was, you know, this super efficient person, and I had figured out how I could do my job in 4 days and be home one day. And so I was negotiating this, and I was told, but no one on the leadership team does that. So you can't. And the problem is I listened, and I went back full time. And that was my mistake. And so sort of fast forward to writing a book and then going back to work. And I would like you to know that today I do the same work that I did back then. I also wrote a book, and I also speak all over the country about it. And
I am making it work. I take an awful lot of time off. So it, you know, my advice to you is don't listen to those rules. If you know that you can break those rules and make it work, break the rules and show people that there's a better way to do it.
Okay. Gail, you talk about the importance of having what matters at mm-hmm. different life stages. I'd love to hear you talk more about that.
Okay. Well, I don't subscribe to the usual current marching directions, which is to have it all. I really think that's a false promise, and it just leads to a lot of frustration and disappointment and guilt, particularly for younger women. You may have it all. You won't have it all at once. You may not have it all until you're in your 40s, which is what happened to me. I think what's important is to have what matters, to have what matters, and that changes at different stages of life. So I tried to give a little quickie rundown. In the trying 20s, as I call them, what matters is composing your individual identity from all the different references and finding your group identity, your tribe. Very important to have a tribe that makes you to which you belong. And trying out possible partners to develop the capacity for intimacy. I mean, real intimacy, you know, his or hers and yours. And that doesn't happen by swiping through profiles and sexting. It actually requires face-to-face and even body-to-body contact and forming an actual messy human relationship. And then one other thing that matters is, that comes later. That's in the turbulent 30s, I call them, because so much happens then. What matters is daring to fail early and often. That's really the only way to be innovative, is to try and fail and try again until you fail forward. And along the way, you'll be building a network of connections and possible partnerships where you may even develop a business together with people because you brainstorm together and create something fabulous, which is what most of the innovators in Silicon Valley have done. They've always had a great partner.
Great. And we'll definitely get to the next stages of life.
Okay.
But first, let's hear from Carrie. If we think that balancing it all with a partner is difficult, balancing it all as a single mom with a different network is even more challenging. Tell
right.
us about that.
Right. So how many are single mothers in the room or single parents? And just out of curiosity, how many of you who are single mothers are entrepreneurs or have your own business?
Only
interesting.
One. Wow, only one.
It's really what makes our life work, right? We're not 9-to-5ers, we're 5-to-9ers. Yeah. So, you know, I think that you can't understand the life of a single mom until you're in that situation where you have a deadline and you're at your office and you know you need to get this project done and the teacher at the school calls you and says your child is projectile vomiting and you need to come and get them right now. And either it's not your former spouse's week or you don't have anybody else to turn to. And what do? So one of the first things that I suggest is that, and I'm a producer, so I pre-produce my life. And if you're a single mother, you need to pre-produce your life. So you need to have a plan. And that's where the village, engaging your village, comes into play. And then you need to have a backup plan to your plan when your plan fails. So I live that way. And I also, once you do that, because your kids are your most important, they are the most important things in our lives. They should be, right? And so they come first all the time. And by the way, you should work with people, if you can, who also have children because they will understand your situation, right? And then when you know that you have your kids set up, you have your plan in place, then you can and should, and it's okay, to compartmentalize your life. Okay? So when you're at work, you're at work. And when you're at home, you're at home. And be really focused on what you're doing and what you're engaged in. And don't worry about it. You've got to release the guilt. Because truly, that feeling of guilt, what does it accomplish? Anyone? Exactly. It accomplishes nothing. All it does is it makes you feel bad, and it can actually make you ill. It can make you physically ill. Mm-hmm. So you need to release it and be okay with where you are and what you're doing. And the final thing that I do, because it's the only way I can live my life, is to be very organized. And I am the queen of to-do lists. So have your daily tasks, and then have your schedule. And sometimes I even, when I know I have a busy day, I'll schedule my workouts into my day. Sometimes I'll schedule my showers into my day. So, you know, it kind of works for me. And I actually, on my website, I have a special gift for all of you. It's like a single mom's toolkit. And so you just go ahead and you can go to my site, and it's CarrieZane.com/Texas. And you can find all these things, these tools that'll help you stay organized and be creative and juggle the best that you can.
Okay. I'd love to hear the other two panelists, since you've introduced the idea of guilt, which was a very common theme in the room. Talk about that a little bit. Why it comes to us and what we can do about it. Guilt both on the work side and on the family side. Gail, do you want to take that?
Well, I thought I had it all planned. The worst advice I got was, you have to be married by the time you're 25 because the gene pool thins out after that of the best men. So I made it to 23. And then I put my husband through medical school and internship, and he rewarded me by having an affair that he wasn't unable to break. So when I was 28, I was blindsided by a divorce that I had to dare to take, because the most important thing to me then was to save my self-respect. And I had to wrestle with the guilt because I had a 2.5-year-old daughter. And so I'm depriving her of a father, but I'm not going to be able to be a decent mother if I'm feeling really lousy about myself all the time. So I wrestled with that for some years, and then I came to the conclusion by the time I was in my early 30s that this was the right decision and that I was going to be able to make a real life for us, and I was going to be able to give my child an education much better than the one I had, and she was going to help, and she was going to learn how to be independent earlier than she might have if she had a full family. So I shed some of the guilt. It's still there. I still fight with it sometimes, but if you're doing something active with that is your mission in life, your dream, I think it erodes the guilt.
I think that we, all of us who are women in this room, which is most of us, need to look at the men in our lives when we feel guilty and compare ourselves to the men. Look how... And I'm not saying this to put men down, so I'll finish before you think I'm putting men down. But women internalize guilt in a way that men don't. So if you look at how really great dads parent their children, they might give them pizza a couple nights in a row. And I'm thinking of my really wonderful husband who's been known to do that. He doesn't feel guilty about it. If he gives them pizza a couple nights in a row, it's because he had to work a lot and he didn't have time to go to the grocery store, and he knows that they're going to be okay. Whereas I and the women I know in my life will be fretting about, you know, flaxseed oil and are they getting enough DHA and their brains are growing, and these things are important, but not to the, I think sometimes we take it too far and we just make ourselves nuts. One study that I'm sure you've read about, Joan, was done by Ellen Galinsky many years ago. It's called Ask the Children. And what I love about the study is she asked what children needed from their working parents. And I think in the study she also asked parents what they thought the children would say. And a lot of parents were expecting their children to say, "I want mom and dad to spend more time with me." But guess what they said? "I want mom and dad to feel less stress." Mm-hmm. So think about that. Think about how you're internalizing that stress. It's not good for you, and it's not good for your kids.
And the study also said that children wanted more time with their dads.
Yes.
They did not express that they wanted
more time with
their moms.
they did want to see their dads.
Yeah. More pizza. The other thing I think is important to think about is how this whole ratcheted up notion that if you're a good mother, you're monitoring the omega-3s and making the baby food and taking the baby to 7 different lessons. You know, are you doing it for the child, or are you doing it to alleviate your own anxiety about where the child would end up? This pattern of what's called the cult of intensive motherhood, it's almost a cult, has come on with increasing inequality in the United States. And it is true that we all want our children to be in on the game and in on it in a way that doesn't end them up poor. That's a real issue in this society. But there's a real risk that what we're communicating to our kids is performance pressure. That if they don't perform and develop every single tiny little talent to the nth degree, we will be disappointed in them. And what we really want to communicate is that we want them to be full, happy human beings. Not that we want them, not that the guy with the most toys wins. So I think one of the important ways to alleviate the guilt is to have a more realistic and, frankly, a healthier vision of what it means to be a good mom. We've talked a lot about motherhood, but as Gail knows, caregiving doesn't end with motherhood, and I'd love to transition to that topic, Gail.
Well, the average family caregiver is a woman who's 47 years old and still has at least one or more children at home. So she and half of them are working and full-time, and most of them work at least part-time, because as we know, I don't know, is it 75% of women are partial breadwinners, if not full. So they're pulled in every possible direction. So I've written a whole book about this because I was a caregiver for my husband through multiple bouts of cancer over the course of 17 years. Well, it wasn't just one long horror, because we did have long respites in between that where we felt very victorious and where we worked together and we just became operating like one being. It was amazingly good for our relationship. But what I learned was along the way, and I laid out in a book called Passages in Caregiving, I called it the labyrinth of caregiving, because it's like a circle. It's not linear, like going through stages of life. And you go around and around, and you can't see where you're going, and you double back, and you go back over the same thing. But the most important, sort of halfway through, everybody gets to the point where they say, I can't do this anymore. And that's usually about 2 to 3 years in, and that's when people call the hotline. And you're right, you can't do it anymore. You have to have a circle of care. And the best advice I can give is to form that circle of care before the crisis, before mom falls down or dad has an accident and he can't remember how it happened. You know, have a nice, some kind of a celebratory occasion where you invite your siblings and you make it fun, not on a holiday. And then you all talk about, you know, well, what are our gifts? You know, what are all of our strengths? You know, who's the numbers person in the family? Who's the hands-on person? You know, who's the natural social worker? What can we all bring to the table if and when mom and dad are no longer, you know, climbing Machu Picchu? And that makes it so much easier, so that one person, usually the woman who lives closest to mom or dad, gets stuck with it and then feels that it's her job, and she will burn out. And finally, I say the last and the most important phase is coming back. Coming back is something that the caregiver has to do to come back to herself, to who she is, to her identity, to what gives her life meaning before she loses her loved one. Because if she's just a caregiver at that point, she has no role. She has no identity. She's lost. And I did find that out, it's a big deal. And it doesn't only happen once. I mean, you know, the first time when you're 47 or 49, and then the second time when you're 55, and maybe the third time for an in-law when you're in your 60s.
Thank you. Thank you. This question is for Katrina. Katrina, how do you know when you need to make a little change, like getting more efficient with your time, and when you need to make a big change, like when your manager just doesn't get it? In other words, when you're feeling stress, how do you know whether it's the solution is inside you or outside you?
That's a question I get a lot. A lot of women write into me who've read my book and want to know, like, how do I know if I'm really maxing out or I'm just having a mini max out? I mean, my answer is you know. You know the signs in your body. For me, the signs were my anxiety was increasing. I started having panic attacks. I started getting very depressed, which is not my normal state of mind. I couldn't kick out of it. Everyone's signs are different. I've heard of all kinds of crazy stuff at this point, people having seizures from stress. And so you don't want to get to that point. And I think, you know, the real lesson in this is prevention. And if you feel like you're kind of inching toward your limit, back away from that limit. Do whatever it takes. My experience has been that the workplace will take every square inch of your life if you let it. And so a lot of the thinking and writing that I've been doing is around how do you get that time back and still be effective in your career and still, you know, get promoted and still kind of find fulfillment. But the good news is there are so many things we can do now. There's so many different arrangements we can make, from job shares to part-time work to flexible schedules, that can really just relieve that little bit of pressure so that you can get what you need.
I guess my answer to that is when you feel like you have to spend so much time getting your composure back so you can present to your children the kind of childhood that you hope they have, time to leave. That Carrie, I have a different question for you, or you can answer that one. I'll give you a choice. Many of us have trouble saying no. How do you do it? When do you decide when to do it?
Mm-hmm. I have a whole chapter about that in my book, because I have such a hard time saying no. Anybody else? We are women. We are nurturers. You know, and there are ways to say no, and there are places to say no, and I think it's when you start feeling that maxed out is when you have to start inserting that word, you know, and for example, with our children, I think that you have to be really emphatic about how you say your no, because I think as women, we'll say, you know, I don't really think we can do that. Okay. You just gave them an in, you know, and they want to know, they want you as parents to be definitive about your thoughts. So be really emphatic about the no. And there are times when I think, you know, we talk a lot about, like, all of us are being stressed and have so much, and we put so much on ourselves. And so sometimes it's okay to just let go, you know. So what are your boundaries? Like, for example, if you want your kid to clean their room, which I still haven't figured out, my daughter's 23, is if she's not going to clean it up, it's like, okay, then what can we do? You know, empower them to give you an option. And if all it is that they're going to clean the top of their desk, okay. You know, they're cleaning something, and you are getting something from it too, and you're not engaging in a war that is unnecessary. You know, so it's all about that carefully placed no.
I mean, saying no is hard for women, because if you look at prescriptive stereotypes, the way women are supposed to be, women are supposed to be helpful and nice. That's what the studies show. Men, they're supposed to be ambitious and commanding. So if you as a woman say no, you're not being helpful and you're not being nice. Mm-hmm. And what does your name begin with, ladies? Yeah, B. And so the solution, and this is one of the strategies in the What Works for Women at Work book, is what we call gender judo, which is doing a masculine thing, saying no, but in a feminine way, to try to avoid the backlash for violating those prescriptive stereotypes. And so, for example, a huge issue that we talk about in the book is what I call the office housework. Now, this is not literal housework. but it's work in the office that women magically do that is not career-enhancing work. Mm-hmm. And somehow men are magically never asked to do this work. Mm-hmm. And so when you're asked to do it, what you do is what we call the strategic no, or the say no by saying yes, but. Mm-hmm. You know, I would love to serve on the Paperclips Committee for the sixth year in a row. But unfortunately, I'm helping Rich with this major strategic initiative. But you know who would be perfect for you? Tom down the hall. Let's transition to takeaways, because I know that everyone in this room wants to walk away with some very, very concrete takeaways that they can use going forward. Do you want to start us out, Gail?
Well, one of the things that, I've been interviewing too many women in their mid-30s when I think most women have a kind of a midlife crisis, who say, I forgot to get a child. And then, you know, like, get a child. So, you know, and then if they've been very efficient and very, you know, at their work, you think, well, I can just get this family thing done in a year. I'll find the guy and, you know, we'll get it going. And then, you know, it's 3 years and then they're 39. And now you're going to be lucky if they have one child, you know, maybe two. So, I think a very good thing to do is when you have the right partner, I hear a lot of women say, you know, I can't wait to have a baby. Well, having the baby is the easy part, right? Being a mother is like your lifetime obligation. So you have to really make that distinction. And so I think one of the things to do with the partner, and I hope you have a partner, because as Carrie and I both know, being a single mom is a tough road to hoe. But I'm just thinking, and this is somewhat in jest, lay out your priorities with your partner before the child comes, who's going to do what and when, and then you have to have a penalty for failure, right? So how about restricted sex? There's a whole Greek tragedy about that.
One thing I want to just point in, and I'm sure that Carrie will jump in, is that many, many people who are single parents, they aren't single parents at all. They have a network of caregiving. It may not be with one individual partner. It may be with a network of friends. But there are different ways to organize intimacy, and nobody ever said that one-on-one was the only way. Right. Carrie, that's probably your cue to say some takeaways.
Yeah. Well, interesting segue. And I do think it takes a village, and I know that many of you who have husbands who are busy or working or not helping, you know, you need to have your girlfriends. There was an email thing that went around, and it was like, you know, men may come and go, but girlfriends last forever. Right. Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And it's so true. It's so true. And family too is very critical in support. But, you know, one of the things that I wanted to share with you to hopefully take away, because I think what we realized in our conversation is that a lot of the things that we struggle with are really in our heads. You know, we take on a lot of the responsibility that I think the media hands us, and then we get all stressed out about it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to propose to you that maybe at some point you can just stop and, you know, we talk about forgiving others, but take a moment to self-forgive. Right? So if you're in that place where you're so busy and you didn't go to your kids, whatever, just forgive yourself for judging yourself for being a bad mother. You know, it's okay because you're doing the best that you can. Right? And the other thing that I propose in my book, and I made up a word and I don't know if it will ever hit Yahoo or, you know, like Urban Dictionary, but it's to be a best spectationer. So it's the combination of best expectations. And I hope you all experience that today, because what it is knowing that every single day something is going to happen, or you're going to meet somebody, or you're going to get an email or a text or a phone call or someone today. And I hope you all meet someone, that 10 people that you don't know today. And it is going to spin your life around in 180 degrees in a positive way. And even if it seems negative,
it's a positive. If you believe it, it'll happen. Yeah.
Katrina.
Okay, so I know that in these conference sessions, often we talk in really lofty terms about how we can balance our lives, and so I want to get really specific for a second. I wrote down a list of specifics about ways to make room for yourself in your life. So one of the things that happens, that is actually happening with this generation of women who's now raising families, is we have fewer friendships than we used to have with other women. We have fewer and less strong, so I guess weaker, relationships with other women than our mothers did. And this has a serious impact on our sense of well-being mm-hmm. and our sense of purpose. And so a couple of the things that I've found, because I'm working a lot and my friends are all working, we're all super busy, and so some of the things I've found to reconnect with my friends are these. We do meal swaps, and this is very informal. So I'll make a pot of soup, I'll double the recipe, and if I have it in me, I'll just drive it over to a friend's house who lives hopefully 5 minutes or less away. And it's this lovely, spontaneous surprise, and she doesn't have to make dinner one night, or her husband doesn't. And it's sort of like this good feeling that goes around. I have regular phone therapy sessions with my friends when we're commuting. So that commute time, go hands-free, wear your headset. But that can be a really good time to just connect with friends. Another thing that we'll do is take our kids to birthday parties. If I'm going to the kid birthday party, why don't I take your kid too, and then you can have 2 hours to yourself. These are little things, but they strengthen our relationships to each other, and that's really important. Making room for yourself at home is really important, and I'm just going to say one thing about this for those of you who do not yet have kids or have really young kids. Make sure that if you are in a relationship, whether you are married or in a same-sex relationship, that your partner stays home with that baby for like a week, 2 weeks, as much time as they can get.
3 months.
Yeah, ideally. So we're all wanting to go in the same direction, paid parental leave, but we don't have that yet. So whatever it takes, make sure that your partner gets that time, because what the studies show is that when men have time alone to take care of their infant, they really bond, and that bond lasts on, you know, much later in life when they're back at work, and so they take on more responsibility at home, which means it's not all on you. And the last thing I'll say, and this is a segue to you, Joan, is about making room for yourself at work. I think it's really important for people to know that companies with more women actually make more money.
Mm-hmm.
They make higher profits, and they do better on the stock exchange. There's several studies that I've seen that show this. And so it's important to kind of internalize that, because when you go to your boss, like I did, and you say, here's my plan. I need to work a four-day week. This is how I'm going to make it work. It's going to be great for the company. And they say no. You're a little more confident about not taking that no for an answer. And I think you have other advice about how to advocate at work that I think people should hear.
Yeah, if you want a different schedule at work, the way not to do it is to say, oh, my God, I'm so overwhelmed. I totally need a new schedule, or I just don't know what I'm going to do. No. What you do is to say, I have thought through this new schedule, and I've discussed it with my work team. This is how the work can get done mm-hmm. if I'm here 4 days a week and telecommute the other day.
Mm-hmm.
I've discussed all the ways we'll keep in touch. And this is how it will work, for example. Or I want to work 4 days a week, and here's how the work that I'm now doing on the fifth day can be done by a different person, a contractor, and you'll end up saving money. You need to present the business case, because mm-hmm. if you present the business case, why shouldn't they give it to you? And if you don't present the business case, why should they give it to you? It's just mm-hmm. another managerial headache. Mm-hmm. So that's the way to negotiate a part-time or telecommuting schedule. That's the first bit of advice. The second bit of advice I've said a couple times, but it's so important I'll say it again, which is think through what you're communicating as a mother. Are you communicating performance pressure on yourself and on your kids? Or are you communicating that you want them to be good, calm, serene people And you're a good, calm, serene person and not sweating the small stuff, and it's almost all small stuff. The third picks up also on something the other panelists have said. Men who take parental leave change their relationship with their children forever, mm-hmm. and I'm not talking about 2 weeks. That is not parental leave. That is a short vacation. Mm-hmm. Taking parental leave means taking 3 months off. Men have a legal entitlement in this country, in large companies, to take 3 months off. Mm-hmm. And what one of the revolutions I've seen in my years as doing this professionally is that men my age and Gail's age thought they were good fathers if they were what I call special event fathers. Mm-hmm. If they showed up to the ballet recital, they were fabulous. They are really doing their job well. There's an increasing number of younger men who see being as a good father as in being involved in the daily care of children. This is their aspiration. Mm-hmm. This is their ideal. This is their dream. We need to help them get there. Mm-hmm. We look forward to your questions. Okay. In pre-producing, I think what I mean by that is it's like in case of an emergency, you know, what are you going to do, right? So it's knowing that you have your village in place so that if you have an emergency, like I suggested, you know, you're at work and you need somebody to help you with your kids, who is that? Who are you going to call? I had a situation when my daughter was an infant and I was still married, but my former husband went away and I went out. I had a babysitter and I came home and I had to take the babysitter home and the baby was in the crib and I didn't know what to do, you know, because I didn't have my backup plan. So, you know, thank goodness my parents don't live far away and I called them at midnight. God bless my mother. And she came over to watch the baby so that I could take the babysitter home. Mm-hmm. So that's I shouldn't have had that. I should have had my backup plan in place. I should have had that evening pre-produced. Does that make sense? Okay.
Also, keep in mind that Carrie is a producer. This is her disposition.
Hi. A little bit short. I'm taking notes for my blog, and one concept I want to make sure I write about is you said be a spectator. Can you expand, like, say it a little slower and explain?
Yeah. See, that's the problem. I'm never going to make it to Urban Dictionary. It's the word best, spectationer. I wish I had a board, I would write it. But it's that notion of combining best expectations. And it is just living in the knowing that something good is going to come out of your day. And it may totally come from left field. You know, I had the other day, I'm working on a single mom gift giveaway that I do on my blog. And I was talking to this publicist and I said, well, do you know, think you could donate something to the giveaway? Cause I love to give gifts to single moms. I think we deserve it. But, and she said, you know, that's really great. And I'm thinking, you know, have you ever done any media? Because I'm thinking that I could, you know, promoted on KTLA or, and I was like, oh, are you kidding me? That would be so great. You know, and it was totally unexpected. I didn't know that was going to happen. And it was such a beautiful gift. So it's just knowing that those things will come into your life if you're open to it.
Can I add something to that? I think one of the great ways to avoid the guilt, is as you're going, putting your head down on the pillow at night and going over your guilt list, all the things that you didn't do, that you didn't accomplish. Replace that with your gratitude list.
Yeah.
Make a gratitude list. You just have to have three things that you're happy about. Yeah. You know, maybe just one of them is you're still here.
This is something you can do with your kids, too. We do a three good things. We have this little ritual at dinner, and everyone says three good things from their day. Mm-hmm. Harder to get the teenagers to do it now that they're older, but you can try.
Work-related question, looking for some advice. We have a system at work where our customers can submit notes of recognition about your performance. And our leadership posts the feedback that they get through this recognition tool on a SharePoint site so that everyone on the team can see it. And my question is, I've done a little research and asking around, and I found out that my male peers are actually going to the customers soliciting for them to put this recognition feedback in the system, but yet myself and my female peers don't do that.
Wait.
So I'm wondering, is it appropriate for us to be doing that? Because me personally, I don't think it's appropriate that either gender should be doing that.
I will take this because this comes directly from the four patterns of gender bias. Self-promotion is expected of men. Men are supposed to be ambitious and self-confident. Mm-hmm. Women who self-promote often encounter pushback. Who do you think you are? She's a shameless self-promoter. Mm-hmm. And that's why the women don't feel it's appropriate and the men are doing it. I think that helps kind of bleach some of the emotion out of it. Mm-hmm. Is the manager who designed this a man?
Yes.
So he thinks, you know.
Several levels up the chain.
Yeah, yeah. So he's doing just what comes naturally. And my advice is, you know, when you're in Rome, do as the Romans do. The men are under intense pressure to show that they are men to be reckoned with. They will be self-promoting. I promise you that. Mm-hmm. You gals, you just need to do it. Do it calmly, graciously, not in a braggy way, just very matter-of-fact. And the other thing, the other strategy is what we call the posse. You can be doing it for each other, mm-hmm. which is even better, the studies show. If you have a third person singing your praises, it's more effective even than you doing it yourself.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
I'm a caregiver for my husband, and I have four adult children. They are all professional. One of them is in better shape than the others. She's an RA. But I'm having a real hard time with that daughter helping out. And I just want some advice.
Well, I think you have four children, one of whom, which is a daughter?
Yes.
And the others are sons?
One son and two more daughters.
And they don't, the boys don't think they have to pitch in at all?
This is a daughter. She's an RA. I was there.
Well, I'll tell you what one family did where the primary caregiver, the eldest daughter who'd never married and had seven siblings, and mom was had sundowner syndrome, was wandering around all night long and then would sleep during the day, and the elder daughter who was the caregiver had to go to work and work as a claims adjuster, and she'd come home and finally she fell down the stairs because she was so sleep deprived. So she finally sent out a memo, she and her sister, to the rest of the family members saying, we hate to say this, but we can't do this anymore. We're probably going to have to put mom in a nursing home. That got everybody's attention. And so I think to say you come to the end of the rope, or you're going to lose your own life, or you're going to get sick yourself, and then there won't be anybody to take care of dad, is a way to actually, you know, ring an alarm bell and get everybody together to then say, how can each one of you help? You know, one day or one night or one afternoon in the weekend, I need help from each of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One of you said earlier that work would eat up every inch of your life if you let it. I actually have the opposite problem. I have a dream work week now, the reduced hours, work for myself. That's all great, and now I'm starting to feel edged out of my work, which I love because my kids are eating up every single second of my day. Can anyone speak to that, or feeling resentful or missing out on your work rather than the other way around?
Well, I think it's exactly what Joan was talking about. I mean, the standards for a good mother are crazy now. They're absolutely crazy. I have three kids, and on the weekends, I don't know how we get through the weekends, and I don't feel like I'm trying to keep up with anyone. I feel like I'm just trying to give a baseline of, you know, everyone gets a sport. Like with all these things, I don't think there's a quick, easy solution, but it's the answer is within yourself. If you're, you know, if do you feel like you're doing too much for your kids? You do.
Your transition phase where they're kind of independent, but they can't drive yet. They're driving going crazy.
Wait, how old are they?
I have really old children. They're 15 and one is 19, but she goes back in.
Okay. Yeah, they need to start doing stuff for themselves. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Would everyone agree? Is this true? You have our permission to start pushing back on your kids and set some boundaries.
Can I put in a word here?
Yeah, please.
Because I'm writing a book about daring. I had to go back to, you know, are people who are daring born that way, or are they shaped that way by the way they're raised? And like everything else, it's a combination. But a lot has to do with the way children are raised. And a wonderful study done in Sweden following young kids and seeing which of them came out when they were in teenage. They were most ready to take risks and least reticent about taking risks. And what it was the kids who had been able to, when they were like 3 and 4 years old, play with knives and scissors and learn how to do it. And then kids who actually, you know, were left to go into the woods when they're a little bit later and spend 2 or 3 hours in the woods, mom not knowing exactly where they are or who they're playing with. And maybe they come back with a scraped knee or, you know, a bruised friendship, but they learn about that. And even more than that, my experience was my grandmother kept my secret when I was 9 years old, and we lived in a suburb of New York, and we used to listen to a radio show called Grand Central Station, and it was very thrilling. It would have like the sounds of trains, and it was all about crossroads of a million private lives. And I wanted to go to Grand Central Station and see these private lives so I could write little stories about them. And my grandmother said, well, why don't you go on a Saturday morning? And I said, Mom and Dad would never let me. She said, well, they won't know. And so I literally got on the commuter train and went 45 minutes in New York, went up to the balcony and watched the million private lives. And I'd see a man with a Borsellino hat come and meet a woman with dark glasses. And I'd say, exchange conversation, then move apart and say, they must be communists. And I'd write a story about them. So, and I would ride back home and my parents never found out. And that was, I think that was like the base daring act of my life.
Wow. Can we give a round of applause to the speakers? Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your stories. I know all of us are going to take a lot from the panel. Absolutely outstanding. Thank you.